You're very welcome, or indeed welcome back, to the Firm and Fast Golf Podcast. I'm your host, Shane Darby. In this episode, we're joined by Canadian golf architect Jeff Mingay to take a look at a pioneer of golf design, the Pacific Northwest of Canada and the United States. The name Arthur Vernon McCann will undoubtedly be known by some of you. However, many listeners may be encountering McCann's name for the very first time. An Irish immigrant with a talent and love for the game of golf, McCann moved to Canada in 1912 as a 30-year-old, and in so doing, brought John Lowe's principles of strategic golf design to British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and indeed a smidgen to California. Mac would volunteer to fight as a part of a Canadian overseas expeditionary force in World War I, ultimately paying the price in losing a leg as a result of injuries incurred on the battlefield of Vimy Ridge. Jeff helps us to understand how McCann's influenced the growth of golf in the Pacific Northwest and how his endeavours were forgotten through the passage of time until the likes of himself and historian Mike Rist rediscovered what was lost. Mingay has spent over 20 years in the golf design business, initially starting with Rod Whitman and Mike DeVries. He started his own design studio in 2009, focused on providing golfers with memorable experiences and indeed equipping his clients with a sustainable foundation for future success, journeying to the near future by way of the past. Many thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the show. Jeff Mingay, you're very welcome to the Firm and Fast Golf Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Not a problem at all. You've officially become the second Canadian to appear in the show after multiple appearances by Jasper Miners. So it's always good to have a Canuck on board.
Yeah. Of course it is. We know it.
Listen, before we get stuck into our main focus, you might let us know what currently has you in Nova Scotia.
Good question. I have a particular fondness for Nova Scotia after working on the initial development, early stages of the development of Cabot Links years ago, beginning in the early 2000s. But right now I'm in Halifax and working on a plan to improve the new course at Ashburn Golf Club. Interesting club, historic club founded in the early 20s, if not prior. They have a shorter golf course in town in the city that was that is attributed to Stanley Thompson. And back in the late 1960s, they hired another Canadian, Jeff Cornish, to lay out a new course for the club north of the city, about a half hour's drive outside of Halifax. That opened in 1970. So the club's at a point where Ian Andrew has redone their Stanley Thompson course in the city. He did that about a decade ago, I believe. And now we're looking at opportunities to improve the new course as well. It's a neat club, 36 holes, one of the only private golf clubs in the Maritimes here in Canada. Really nice vibe around the place. So coincidentally, actually, I was out this morning. They're hosting the Canadian Women's Amateur Championship this week as well. So I was out on the golf course early before golfers work on the plan. And then I spent the rest of the morning watching these wonderful women play extraordinary golf.
Excellent. Sounds like a wonderful morning.
It's a good week. I'm not going to complain.
Good stuff. Listen, before we jump into the main event, I understand that much of Canada is currently struggling in trying to contain some wildfires, having experienced the atmospheric conditions that the bushfires in Australia created back in Melbourne in 2020. My thoughts are with anyone that has to deal with anything similar. Have you come across anything nearer to you in terms of effects?
You know, personally, no, I haven't. I've been watching just like you and seeing how many fires have been going on across our country, but it really hasn't affected me too much. I mean, I've crisscrossed the nation here quite a bit this year, and other than the odd smoke, bit of smoke here or there in British Columbia and Nova Scotia. It really hasn't affected me personally too much or anyone I know, thankfully.
Well, listen, once again, many thanks again for joining me today. I must make an early confession to listeners. Additional credit is due to your good self and an unreserved thanks for prompting me to momentarily turn my attention away from dune geology and early golf towards A.V. McCann as the focus of our chat today. If truth be told, I've bitten off quite a chunk in relation to a longer-term project on golf in the Netherlands, and this is a great diversion and is very welcome and very worthwhile. Notwithstanding the fact that I'm always keen to shine a light on fellow Irish golf tragics, and Arthur Vernon McCann certainly fits this criteria. For listeners that may not know Jeff Mingay, at least initially, perhaps you might give us a wee introduction to your good self and your journey in golf to this point, sorry, to the point in becoming an associate of Canadian course architect Rod Whitman.
Sure. I was lucky enough to grow up playing a fantastic 1929 golf course designed by Donald Ross at Essex Golf and Country Club in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Yeah, which is right across the river from Detroit. I always loved telling this story. It was early 70s. The club had about an average age of an average membership age of about 80. So they thought we better get some young guys in the club. So one of the young guys in town that joined Essex, and I think it was 1972 or 73, was my dad. Very discounted rate because, again, they really needed to blow some life into the place. And then when I turned 10 years old, I just became a member. You know, later on in life, people would say, "Oh, you're a member at Essex." I said, "Well, I am, but yeah, I didn't pay the initiation fee that you might think I paid. I just happened to be a little kid who was lucky to play there." But my dad was a real keen golfer. He still is. And not only did he give us, my brother and I, access to that particular club and golf course, but I honestly am astonished still when I look back and, you know, in the mid 80s when I was getting into teenage years, you know, my dad had every famous book on golf history and golf architecture on his bookshelf in his office.
Wow.
He would just subscribe to the classics of golf, and books would show up and he'd read them. And I not only became fascinated with the golf course at Essex, because it still stands the test of time, you know, as 1929 era Donald Ross courses tend to do, but I had, you know, I had access to the golf course, and I also had access to all these books that my dad had, and I gravitated toward them. And I realized that at an early age that people design and build golf courses. And, other than being Jimmy Page, it was basically the only thing I ever aspired to do was try to figure out how I could also design and build golf courses. And then getting back to your follow-up there, after talking to a number of people in the industry, I figured out there was another Canadian guy who had worked for Pete Dye, knew how to run bulldozers and excavators, and his name was Rod Whitman. And he was building golf courses, and there's no other way to say it. I pestered him for a number of years, told him who I was, what I wanted to do. And eventually he brought me on, I think it was 2000 or 2001. He said, "Hey, I've got a project going on out in Edmonton. If you really want to do this, come on out. We'll find a place for you." And we built Blackhawk Golf Club in Edmonton, Alberta. And I ended up working for Rod for about a decade on a number of different projects before heading out on my own to do my own thing.
Brilliant. And I suppose as part of the prep for today, I came across a really cool quote from Rod's old website, which I think he's repurposed in his new website. But it goes a little bit something like this. "Strategic design coupled with great contour, whether natural or man-made, is the essence of golf architecture, showcasing and enhancing a site's natural attributes relative to interesting golf, contour and slope, wind angle, vegetation and views, always produces the best results. The only way to create golf courses of remarkable distinction is to allow inherent site characteristics to drive design." That seems to be
I guess, a mantra that you've probably taken up as well, obviously as following in Rod's footsteps as a design builder. Would that be fair?
Absolutely. It's funny that triggered some memories. I actually think I may have written that quote back in the day when we were putting together our original promotional materials. But certainly, even if I did write it, it certainly is an inspiration for Rod. Rod's an extraordinary talent. He really is. I was very, very fortunate to run into him when I did, and it was just sort of happenstance for me. I didn't realize when I went to work with him how much of a talent he was and how much I was going to learn. But, you know, it's sort of in vogue these days, you know, for guys to advertise themselves as not only designers, but also shapers and builders and people who run equipment. Rod was one of the originals, you know. He came from the Pete Dye, Bill Coore school. By happenstance, he happened to meet those guys years ago and worked with them building. And, you know, I'm not even going to guess how old Rod is these days. He's however many years young, I'll tell you that. But I've never met a person who has such an ability to see and also build, you know, which is extraordinary talent. The combination of talents for an architect. You know, he's one of the best I've seen at searching a property for golf holes and coming up with extraordinary routings. But again, he gets on that bulldozer and special things happen. I mean, using Cabot Links as an example, I don't think there's a square foot of that ground that Rod didn't personally touch on a bulldozer at some point or another in terms of contouring the entire golf course, and the results speak for themselves.
So I believe you used to hightail it around the country in Canada, visiting as many golf courses as you possibly could and taking as much in as possible, and perhaps a superintendent's conference in Vancouver was where a penny dropped with regard to Mr. Arthur Vernon McCann. Would that be true?
Absolutely. I was quite the golf dork as a kid. Yes, everywhere I traveled, didn't matter if it was big city, small town. First thing I would do is, okay, I'm headed here or there, and I would make a list of you know, every golf course I needed to see in and around that particular city, town, area. Heading out to Vancouver for the Canadian Golf Superintendent's Conference. I think it was around 2000 as well. It was around the same time that I had met Rod Whitman. I thought, okay, I'm going to get around Vancouver and see all the best golf courses. And I started to make a list. At the top of the list was obviously Capilano. I'm sure some of your listeners recognize that name, famous Stanley Thompson golf course in West Vancouver. And then I started making a list of everywhere else I wanted to see: Marine Drive, Richmond, Langara, my mind's escaping me, Shaughnessy. And suddenly, everything underneath Capilano that was worth seeing in Vancouver area had this name A.V. McCann attached to the original design. And I thought to myself, you know, at that point, I had been studying architecture enough to know who Stanley Thompson was, and I knew who Alistair McKenzie was, and A.W. Tillinghast, and all the famous names. And I thought to myself, who is this A.V. McCann guy who designed all these golf courses around Vancouver? This is bizarre history to me that I didn't know. And they were, again, all the best golf courses in and around Vancouver. So I dug a little deeper, and I found out that a gentleman by the name of Mike Rist had been doing a ton of research. This was long before Mike put out a book, a biography on A.V. McCann. And on that same trip, I was fortunate to get together with Mike and have a lunch with him. And he filled me in on a lot of McCann's background and a lot of the history on the development of all those golf courses around Vancouver. And, you know, the short version of a long story is that I suddenly realized that A.V. McCann was talking about and implementing, you know, similar design philosophies and similar looking golf courses to many of the great, you know, architects of the 1920s and 30s era. And that just sort of, you know, sparked this interest, which led me then down into Seattle and throughout Northwest United States and to check out all of McCann's golf courses. And it didn't take long to learn that he was a pioneer in that same vein, you know, as all those famous names in a region that, you know, was kind of an outlier. Like, whoever gets up to Vancouver and Seattle and Portland, we do nowadays, but it's still a little bit of an outlier. But it was really an outlier when he was doing his original work in the teens and early 20s, you know.
So your first solo commission, I believe, was at Victoria Golf Club in British Columbia. Obviously, as you said, located near Vancouver, for those that may still be wondering. And our hero of certainly the first part of our discussion today, Arthur Vernon McCann, joined Victoria upon his arrival from Ireland, no less. We're time traveling here, so best to go back to Dublin in 1882, where the story of Arthur Vernon McCann begins. Over to you.
Yeah, fascinating. He's actually Arthur Vernon McCann Jr., which is an important part of the story. McCann's father was an obstetrician in Ireland in the mid to late 1800s. If my memory serves me correctly, he studied obviously medicine and had made numerous trips over to Prussia and other areas on the continent, and really brought back some revolutionary ideas relative to cleanliness in hospitals. As I understand at the time, let's just say for the sake of conversation, 2 out of 10 women in Ireland during the mid to late 1800s were actually going to the hospital to have children because it was more dangerous to be in the hospital because of the potential infections and things like that, because the hospitals weren't cleanly enough. McCann brought back some things he had learned from the continent and changed the situation in hospitals in terms of childbirth. Where once he was done leading this charge in terms of cleaning up hospitals, 10 out of 10 women in Ireland were having babies in hospitals. So his work actually led to him being knighted. He became Sir Arthur Vernon McCann because of his work obstetrics.
Yeah.
Obstetrics.
There we go.
That always tongue ties me up there. But so his father was very well known and very accomplished physician in Ireland, which presumably allowed young AV to grow up privileged. And he ended up at Trinity College studying law and playing a lot of golf. Not knowing too many details, I do know that he became a very, very proficient player growing up playing golf around Dublin, which led to, playing in high level amateur competitions throughout the British Isles prior to his immigrating to Canada.
Yeah, a special thank you must go out to good friend of the pod, Stephen Proctor, for doing some digging on our behalf yesterday. In fact, he stopped whatever he was doing, most likely some research in women's golf. Jenna Clevar, Joyce Weatherhead, Rona Adair, Eleanor Helm, or maybe Mabel Stringer, perhaps. There's definitely another book coming on the evolution of women's golf, I can assure you of that, and the important pioneers on both sides of the Atlantic. I digress, however. He trawled back through the annals of amateur championships history, which are detailed in the Royal and Ancient Championship Records publication, and unearthed a few pertinent results relating to young A.V. McCann. So in 1909 at Muirfield, young AV, who at the time would have been 27, I guess, received a bye in the first round and lost to a gentleman called D.A. Brown of Penang by 7-6. The following year at Hoy Lake, he once again received a bye in the first round. And the second round, he was defeated by G. Robb of Edinburgh by 4-2. He won the second round in defeating G. Robb of Edinburgh 4-2. And the third round, he actually faced the great two-time amateur champion John Laidlaw from Muirfield, who was, of course, one of John Ball's great rivals. AV took Laidlaw to the 18th and losing one down. Mr. Proctor provided some additional context here via text and commentating that either Laidlaw had a rough day or McCann was a stick. I suspect Mr. McCann was a stick as opposed to Mr. Laidlaw having a rough day, but who knows? Finally, the last record is 1911 in Prestwick, and he won the first round over a J. Reamer of West Lancs and was beaten the second round by a THP Colossar of Sandy Lodge. He may well have taken part in other championships. However, we have reached the limit of my acquired knowledge on AV's participation in the Amateur Championship, shall I say. I understand, if we rewind a second, obviously you said that he enrolled in his father's alma mater in Trinity College in Dublin. Rather than pursue a career in medicine, he elected to study law. I understand also that McCann's decision had very little of it was due to any sincere interest in becoming a barrister. Your friend Michael Rist suggests, rather, it's more likely that McCann sought to become a lawyer because the local bar association had golf club affiliations with the seaside links of Portmarnock and Royal Dublin. So during the years on the team at Trinity College, AV made several trips to St Andrews, out of which sprang a lifelong love affair with the old course. Obviously, knowing what you know, Jeff, what specific features from the old course do you think AV employed in his designs?
Well, that's a great question. He did speak quite highly. I mean, you know, he was an amazing. I mean, you know, he loved golf simply by looking back on his life and seeing how much he did in golf. Not only was he a great player, not only did he get involved with designing and building golf courses, he wrote prolifically as well about everything from architecture to playing instruction to rules issues to everything. You know, you can really tell nowadays, looking back on his life, as you suggested, that he loved golf. There was nothing else he wanted to do except be around golf. It's very, very clear, particularly, you know, reading Mike Rist's book. There was nothing else he wanted to do. Getting back to St. Andrews, though, you know, I think just like every golf architect worth his salt, his or her salt over the past century, it's easy to fall in love with St. Andrews. I mean, it's the same type of stuff we always talk about. You know, it's a functional golf course in terms of it, you know, draining properly, catering to golfers of all ability, and being a very, very distinctive layout. And I think those are really the three pillars that McCann and so many of the great golf course architects of the past really leaned on. You know, you want to build a functional golf course. It caters to the enjoyment of players of all abilities and stands out as distinctive. And I really think that of all places, you know, he ended up bringing that to the Northwest in North America. And his golf courses still speak to the importance of those three pillars that come from St. Andrews effectively.
To your point on AV loving golf, following his marriage to a woman called Juliet Richard in 1911, AV went on to work for his father-in-law at the Richard Law Firm in Dublin. Within a year, his lack of interest in the profession was obvious by all accounts. And Mr. Richard presented him with an ultimatum: practice law or practice golf. McCann chose the latter. So obviously he went and left for Victoria and Vancouver the following spring. So with his pregnant wife in tow, there was speculation that McCann was a remittance man, one who had accepted financial incentive from his family to leave Ireland and never return. This speculation has never been confirmed. However, on arrival in Vancouver, in the Vancouver area, should I say, he had joined Victoria Golf Club. This is 1912, I believe. And obviously he brought his golfing ability over with him and was a golfer of some repute in the Pacific Northwest, I believe, and winning and competing very, very well in some PNGC amateur championships. Is that right?
Yeah, he, you know, it's interesting. That whole remittance man story has always fascinated me. Like, I don't think there's any evidence that his father-in-law told him to get lost and never come back, but he actually did get lost and never came back. His wife and his children actually only lasted a few years in Victoria is actually where they came to, which is just on Vancouver Island, across the water from Vancouver, the Vancouver area. But anyhow, a couple of years after they showed up, his family was already gone, and McCann never went back to Ireland. And as far as I know, had never even gone back to Europe. And that was 1912, and he lived till 1964. Very interesting, kind of confusing. I don't believe there's any way to understand any facts out there to understand exactly why that happened. But you're right. As soon as he got to Victoria in British Columbia, he I think he showed up with news ahead of him, you know, that I think people knew that one of the better amateur Irish golfers was coming to Victoria. He joined, as you say, the Victoria Golf Club. He immediately won the Pacific Northwest Golf Association Amateur Championship. So quickly established himself as a man who was all things golf. He was writing, he was winning, he was teaching. He was all things golf at the time, which then led into the opportunities to start designing golf courses.
Sure. And I guess his first commission was at Royal Colwood. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
So how did the opportunity to work on such a high-profile course materialize?
Well, at the time, 1912, 1913, the Victoria Golf Club felt threatened. It still remains on a very high-priced real estate in an area of Victoria, British Columbia, called Oak Bay. And it's funny that it survived. Here we are talking 110 years later that the club felt threatened a century ago that it may no longer exist because of the price of real estate in that particular area of the city. So a group of members feeling threatened that the golf course may no longer be there said, well, we better build a new 18-hole golf course, because if this thing goes away, we're going to have nowhere to play. So a group of Victorian members at that time bought some land north and west of the city of Victoria out in an area that's now referred to as Colwood. And McCann was engaged to lay out the course. Again, being sort of in an outlier area like Victoria, who are you going to bring in at that time? 1913, 1912, 1913 to lay out a new golf course. Well, you're going to ask the guy who's, you know, proven himself to be a champion golfer and a real, you know, a real intellect, to be honest, in terms of golf, to assist with the layout. So I'm not sure when McCann went to lay out Colwood whether or not he considered himself a golf course architect per se. But here he was with the opportunity to lay out a course and orchestrate its construction.
Wow. So my understanding is that he would design and lay out one more golf course prior to World War One, which I think is Qualicum Beach in Vancouver. I may have butchered that particular pronunciation, so if I have, please forgive me.
It's up the coast on Vancouver Island. Yeah, Qualicum Beach. Okay. You're close. Yeah.
And I understand that AB's fledgling design career was interrupted as a result of the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria and the subsequent outbreak of the First World War. What can you tell us about AV?
I have never heard it put that way, but that was very well put.
Well, there you go. Thank you. What can you tell us about AV and his involvement in the First World War?
Well, you know, one thing that's very interesting is that I'd have to do the math. When was he born again?
1882. So in 17, he would be 35.
You're right. This is what I was getting at. He had no obligation to go to war. I know that. And certainly a different mindset back then, because he was more than enthusiastic to enlist. And he ended up enlisting. He ended up over in Europe. He ended up at Vimy Ridge, the Battle of Vimy Ridge in France. Coincidentally, the other most famous golf course architect in Canadian history, Stanley Thompson, was also at Vimy Ridge.
Wow.
They both fought in that same battle. Thompson came away pretty much unscathed. I shouldn't say that entirely because he knows what happened mentally, but physically unscathed. Mr. McCann, I believe it was his left leg that ended up amputated because of injuries sustained from an explosion that occurred during the Battle of Vimy Ridge, where he was injured. He was brought back to London, again, had his left leg amputated as a result of that battle. And was fit with a prosthetic. And as far as the stories go, referencing Mike Rist's excellent research of his life, McCann continue to play golf. And of course, we know, continue to design golf courses and a prosthetic leg pre-1920, which is pretty astonishing as well.
That's amazing. Another little tidbit that I came across was as he was recuperating from the amputation and getting used to his prosthetic limb, he reacquainted himself with the works of John Lowe, who wrote the seminal book concerning golf in 1903. I'm interested to understand how faithfully, over the course of his career, do you feel that AV followed Lowe's strategic design principles?
You know, he really did. He referenced, again, when you, he wrote a lot, he was quoted a lot throughout his career, and all the way from Royal Colwood to the last projects he was working on in the late 50s and early 60s, he was still referencing John Lowe, just like all the many of the great architects had. McCann was particularly fond of fallaway greens, which is something that John Lowe discussed quite a bit in reference to St. Andrews. You know, McCann loved a green that was either flat or falling away from the line of approach. And he really felt that that was the only way to challenge better golfers relative to really controlling your golf ball. Just the same way St. Andrews does. You know, it always makes me think of the famous 12th green at St. Andrews, right? Which rises up to a plateau from the front, flattens off on the plateau, and then drops away on the backside, right? In order to get your ball up on that plateau, you're either playing a really crafty shot along the ground, you know, to run up that incline at the front and stop on the plateau. You're controlling your ball with trajectory and spin well enough to stop it on that plateau. And when you look at McCann greens, the best ones that remain at all of his best courses throughout the Northwest, he really did go after that John Lowe philosophy of trying to build links features on inland sites, which actually came to bite him in a few instances that I've come across as well. It's one thing to design greens like that when you've got sandy soil and you can have situations where the fairway approach to the green behaves the same way as the green. The problem is in the Northwest, and I've run into this problem restoring some of his stuff too, is that when you've got a sand green or a green that has different, you know, soil and drainage tech characteristics than the approach, it's hard to play those shots in the Northwest. So, you know, you get a fall away green in the wintertime where the architect is asking you to land it short of the green and trickle on. Well, it's often going to plug in the approach. And if you carry it on the green's sand and better drained, it's going to hit the green surface and fly over the back. So there's these interesting challenges, and I've learned a lot in my own architecture, looking at what McCann was trying to achieve and how that actually reacts and plays and behaves in you know, real time and in real situations. But he certainly did bring that John Lowe links philosophy to British Columbia and Washington State early in his life. Tried to.
I understand he was also keen on referencing chapters 19 and 20 of Bobby Jones' book Golf Is My Game, speaking to giving pleasure to the greatest number of players without respect to their abilities. There must always be something. That something must always be within the realm of reasonable accomplishment. Not to be confused with every shot should be playable by all. Would that be the case?
Absolutely. That's another thing that he talked about repeatedly as well, is again, creating golf courses that adequately challenge the best players and at the same time allowing everyone else to get around, you know, in reasonable fashion. He was big on that. He said the most important thing he wanted to do was ensure that the man that pays the bills, you know, was able to enjoy golf most of all on the golf courses that he designed, which again is a very, very tough thing to do. But philosophically or theoretically, you know, the Augusta National, really the original design of the Augusta National was made along similar lines, using contour and slope and width to both challenge the best golfers, but again, at simultaneously allow everyone else to get around. He was also big on not using a lot of artificial sand bunkers in his designs. And the interesting thing about that reference to Bobby Jones's autobiography, and this is long fascinating to me, is that Augusta National opened up in the early 30s, and there were only 22 bunkers on the entire golf course. And I remember reading a quote where I think Alistair McKenzie said that, you know, we've got 22 bunkers on the course, but Jones and I have spoke. We think we can get rid of another three or four, you know, that they didn't feel were necessary. And that was another piece of McCann's, you know, perspective on golf. He felt like if you could use contour and slope well enough to present, again, the adequate challenge and then the accommodation of higher handicap, shorter hitters, beginners, etc., that was the best way to go about it. It wasn't about over-decorating golf courses or doing anything fancy. It was very, very practically based, his philosophy. You know, use contour and slope to drain the golf course, enhance those contours and slopes to provide interest and challenge to better players. And with that, you were able to provide enough width and greens large enough that everyone else could bunt it around, find it, hit it again, and enjoy the game. It's almost so simple that I've noticed it's difficult for people to understand. I think actually that is one of the reasons that McCann's work has not been respected as well as it probably should. I think a lot of his golf courses, as time progressed and after he had passed away, I think a lot of his stuff was sort of looked at as too simple. You know, you'd look into a green, and even though the contour and the slope and everything I just mentioned was providing great golf, I think people started to look at his holes and they just kind of laid on the ground a little too simply. There weren't enough bunkers to jazz up the appearance, you know, and that sort of thing. And I think people said, well, let's put three bunkers around that green that's only got one bunker. You know, and you see that consistently throughout the Northwest and British Columbia, Washington, Oregon. You wonder, you know, you look at it now after reading what he was most often attempting to achieve, and you often look at these golf courses that have been remodeled and you think, well, we don't need those two bunkers over there. And then you look at an old aerial and there's only one bunker around that green. Now that's simplifying it, but I just think people felt his work was a little bit too practical. If that makes any sense in terms of describing it that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess, look, you're going to have to help
me
here.
Which fascinates me.
You're going to have to help me here because you're the local and I'm not. But looking, obviously, he returned from his recuperation after World War One and the amputation and started straight back into it at Inglewood, which I believe is north of Seattle. He'd go on then in 22 to do Manitou and Kelowna. 1923 was Marine Drive. Alderwood, actually, in 1924, perhaps, we can linger here for a while, in Portland, which I believe no longer exists. It became the first course west of the Mississippi River to host the U.S. Amateur Championship. And I believe at one point, AV considered it to be his best design. What happened to it?
Yeah, he was particular. Again, you look back at articles he'd written over the years and you know, him being quoted in various newspapers. He was very proud of Alderwood, particularly because, as you just mentioned, it was the first golf course west of the Mississippi River to host the U.S. Amateur. Again, he was a competitive golfer. He was an administrator, which is something I hadn't mentioned. He was president of the Pacific Northwest Golf Association for a number of years. The amateur trophy there is actually the McCann Cup. When you win the Pacific Northwest Golf Association Amateur Championship, now you win the McCann Cup. So again, to have one of his golf courses become the first in at West in North America to host that championship, he was very, very proud of that. Unfortunately, that golf course was located right next to PDX, which is Portland International Airport.
Uh-huh.
And when Portland International Airport decided to expand, they expropriated.
The eminent domain. Yeah.
Yes. They expropriated Alderwood Country Club. And it is now underneath the tarmac at PDX.
Wow. And just out of interest, let's say that somebody came to you and said, I want to recreate in a Lido kind of way in terms of Sand Valley, right? And I want to recreate Alderwood. Is there enough material out there in terms of aerials and pictures to actually do that? Or is that just a pipe dream of mine, maybe?
You know, first of all, I'm not sure it was the Lido to begin with.
No, I understand that.
Apologies to Mr. McCann. but at the same time, yeah, there, you know, on all the McCann, you know, restorative-based projects I've been fortunate to work on, there's not a tremendous amount of historical materials available. Not in the way we infrequently photographs of every hole. We infrequently find aerials. Aerials are more available, I should say, but there's not a lot of documentation that's made on many of his courses. So often when I'm doing restorative-based work, it's often trying to look at things in terms of how they may be interpreted through reading, you know, his philosophies and quotes about different things he did, and then referencing any historic materials we may have in terms of bunker style, green shapes, et cetera, et cetera. But it's nothing that I've found with McCann courses, unfortunately. Is there enough information to really put it back exactly the way that he had maybe thought it should be on opening day?
Yeah, look, in 1925, a spot not a million miles away from Chambers Bay in Oregon, I believe he designed Furcrest, which we'll come back to because I know you have you've done some restorative work there, which is quite interesting. But we'll come to that in a little while. Columbia Edgewater in 1925, and quite remarkably, this next one is certainly worth having a conversation about: the California Golf Club of San Francisco. So before Mackenzie and Hunter's limited involvement in the late 20s, the original course at West Orange Avenue in San Mateo County in California was designed by Avery McCann with a possible assist for Willie Locke Jr. What do we know of how Avery came to be involved at the Cal Club?
Well, that is a funny story. And as usual, as I just mentioned, there's not a lot of historical information to tell the story perfectly clear. But it appears that Willie Locke, who was a Scottish professional who had been working around the Bay Area, had been commissioned to lay out the California Golf Club. And as the golf course was being constructed, the powers that be at the club were not terribly impressed with what was happening. They felt the greens were too small. There were some faults in the routing, et cetera, et cetera. And I was curious at that time. I think it was the early 20s. So mid-20s, 24-ish or something.
Yeah.
McCann had kind of, you know, he had started working in Victoria, did some work in Vancouver, Seattle, Portland. He was kind of falling down the West Coast. And he had suddenly made his way into the San Francisco area, you know, I think, which proves he was very, very interested in promoting himself and going to work wherever anyone needed him to build a golf course. So having sort of infiltrated the San Francisco market, and not many other golf architects were working in the area at the time, the powers that be at the California Golf Club decided that Willie Locke wasn't the guy. And somehow or another, they handed the job over to McCann, who tweaked, and I guess we could say fixed what the developers of the California Golf Club thought was wrong. So he ended up finishing the routing, which included, you know, tweaking some holes that Locke had laid out, building all the greens. As far as I know, the golf course opened up in pretty rudimentary fashion, whereas the routing was in place and decent, and, you know, and the greens are functional and playable. The bunkering was lacking, and landscaping and things like that had been done to the site. And as you probably know, that's where not too long after Alistair McKenzie and Robert Hunter were brought in. So it's a California Golf Club's a funny amalgamation of, you know, some ideas from Willie Locke, McCann tweaking and fixing some of that work, McKenzie and Hunter coming in to bunker the golf course and doing whatever else they may have done. And then more recently, obviously, is Kyle Phillips sort of taking all of that stuff and melding it into the great golf course that it is now.
Yeah, and I guess after that, we're not too far away from the Great Depression, and I know the Depression had a major impact on McCann's psyche. And indeed, following World War II, he became more budget conscious and aware of maintenance implications. From hearing you on the Good Good Golf podcast, Rob Murray and Adrian Logue, I understand that later in life, he would actually go back and audit or critique his younger self and his former designs. Practicality was the watchword, filling in bunkers, moving them farther away from greens as a result of maintenance considerations. I guess this tallies up nicely with Ross and Tillinghast's work during the Depression in terms of being a bit more budget conscious and practical, as you said before.
Yes. that's an interesting point because it actually has complicated my restorative-based efforts on a lot of McCann courses because exactly as you just explained, you know, you look at Inglewood's a really good example. You know, there's a lot of dramatic stuff at Inglewood from his bunkering from the early 1920s and similarly at Firkrest 1924. That I immediately saw in historic materials and wanted to restore. And then, as you just mentioned too, we had access to some McCann worked until his death in 1964. We had reports of him going back subsequent to those original 1920s era designs. And as you mentioned, critiquing himself and saying, you know, this particular bunker, I don't think it's necessary. This is too severe. We need to get a riding rough unit between the green and the bunker. So we should, as you mentioned too, move that bunker, you know, whatever that width was, I don't remember, but a lot of maintenance considerations, a lot more considerations for higher handicap players, shorter hitters, which again, put me in a strange predicament because I immediately looked at the bolder, more interesting, more visually inspiring stuff that he did originally in the 20s and then read his reports. And he was honestly emasculating, I think, a lot of the original work that he did. And it is very confusing. And I've had to sit in front of committees and say, listen, I think what he did in 1924 is better than what he's talking about in his 1944 report. And then it becomes a subjective conversation, right? So that's been an interesting thing. You rarely see that with older architects because so many architects, you know, had passed away. So many of the great architects from the 20s and 30s era had passed away by the beginning or at least the end of World War II, that they didn't have that type of longevity to get back to their golf courses and again critique themselves. And reading a lot of this, particularly at Inglewood and Firkrest, is where I've seen McCann critique himself the most. And again, it's been an odd predicament for me when I want to restore the great early stuff and not kind of worry about getting a rough mower between the greenside bunker and the putting surface.
Don't worry, Jeff. We will get to the 17th at Firkrest in a wee while. You don't show too much leg yet, okay? I was interested to see some comments by Robert Trent Jones Sr. regarding McCann, which I think come from Mike Rist's book that were certainly around 1990. And he called AV a pioneering designer who was a generation ahead of his time. Today, as in 1990, the professionals have become so proficient at playing shots from 150 yards and less that the greens must be designed to make this shot more difficult. What he was in fact suggesting was that AV was designing these greens back in the 20s.
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, it's that old John Lowe philosophy of you know, not, you know, he spoke frequently, and it's basically paraphrasing Lowe, that, you know, he felt it was a mistake that golfers felt that the green should pitch into the shot. He thought it was awful that greens pitched back to front toward where golfers are approaching from. So they just allow players, particularly good players, he thought it was silly that you'd allow a good player to loft the shot down into a back to front sloping green that basically just caught the shot like a baseball mitt. You know, in his mind, that wasn't golf. And that certainly wasn't golf in John Lowe's mind. So I think what Trent Jones was getting at is exactly that. You know, he built a lot of greens that could simply accommodate golf for everyone, But in order to get the ball close, particularly when, you know, those special pin positions were employed, it wasn't going to be an easy thing on an AV McCann course. And that's also what I suggested earlier. You know, a lot of his best holes, in my opinion, were lay of the land golf holes that were contoured and sloped properly that would never be on the cover of a magazine, because they weren't decorated with fancy looking bunkers or anything, but they just worked on the ground. And they both, again, challenged better players in magnificent fashion. And at the same time, just allowed everyone else to get around and get back to St. Andrews again. That was really what he strived for everywhere. And, you know, you can really see it when you study his best stuff.
Yeah, and he spoke about the use of centerline bunkers, I believe, particularly that St. Andrews was plastered with them, and that there is in golf architecture, the golf architectural world, too much of the very best authority for me to have to make any apology for advocating centrally located bunkers. Have you found that he utilized these centrally located bunkers widely, or did he use them sparingly?
Well, it's funny. I think that quote, which I love that quote. That's one of my favorite McCann quotes. I think that quote came from him when he was building Shaughnessy in Vancouver, which is probably his best known golf course. But what people don't realize is that there's hardly any McCann left there. And he did, and this was later in his career, but Shaughnessy was really the culmination of everything he had learned from 1912 through the late 50s, I believe it was when Shaughnessy was constructed. And he had gotten to the point where he had really, really minimized the tools that he needed to make a great golf course. And I think, again, that was what was so misunderstood about Shaughnessy. It was such a simple design where he did employ a number of centrally located bunkers at that golf course. And it was really just centered around, you know, a big 60-yard wide corridor and a really thoughtfully designed green with a bunker in the middle of the fairway. And you were obligated as the golfer to look down the fairway, see where the pin was that particular day, and decide where you needed to drive it relative to the center of the fairway being occupied by this sand hazard. Should I go left? Should I go right? Should I stay short? Should I try to carry it? You know, basic golf architecture 101 stuff that you'll find in John Lowe's 1903 book. And I think just people really, really misunderstood the strategy. They weren't, particularly in the Northwest, I don't think people were brought up on golf where the fairway is defined as a 30-yard wide corridor and your objective is to hit it down the middle and then to hit it onto the middle of the green. I think that people just didn't buy in at the time to that type of strategic thought in golf architecture. And Shaughnessy was changed very, very quickly after it opened for play. Which is very frustrating to me, because I've been fortunate to do a little bit of work at Shaughnessy, and I've delved into its history, and I think it's actually one of the most fascinating golf course designs I've seen in the history of Canadian golf. But I certainly do also understand that it was probably very, very difficult to interpret for a lot of golfers. It was difficult for them to get into the intellectual nature of the design. I really do. And that's a huge compliment to McCann. I think there's a lot of little nuances and idiosyncrasies that were either never recognized or taken for granted or not appreciated, which led, again, Shaughnessy is the best example of one of his most thoughtful designs really just, you know, being changed immediately for vanity reasons, really, and reasons that people just simply didn't understand.
Sure, and he would pass away eventually in 1964. As you said, he outlived many of his contemporaries, be it Colt or Thompson or McKenzie or Tillinghast, Ross, etc., etc. And really, you know, by the early 2000s, we've established that he's the forgotten man. Until that is, Mike Rist started doing some research and a young man came out from behind Rod Whitman's shadow and started. Actually, your very first job was Victoria Golf Club. After your first solo job after the Cabot Links project, maybe you might tell us a bit more about the 75 acres that make up Victoria Golf Club, and you know what you were tasked in doing in relation to your first gig as a solo architect.
Yeah, it's actually 98.
Beg your 98 pardon. Acres. Beg your pardon. Beg your pardon.
Yeah, which is still way too few acres to have a functional 18-hole golf course on most of the time. McCann showed up there 1912, as we mentioned. The golf club had been there since 1893. Between 1893 and about 1925, they played numerous versions of a course on the same property. It's very fascinating, actually. There's maps that show, I think it's at least five or six different routings over the club's current property between, again, 1893 and 1925. In 1925, McCann formalized the 18-hole routing into what it is today. And it really is a, as you've said, a masterclass in routing. To fit 18 holes on 98 acres, you cross over the sixth fairway and route from the 10th green to the 11th tee. You cross Brilliant. The first fairway en route from the 17th green to the 18th tee.
That's surely not safe though, Jeff. It's not safe.
There's a main road, Beach Drive, that chops the golf course in half.
Wow.
Half the golf course is on the ocean side, half the golf course is on the inland side, with Beach Drive again, creating that chop in half scenario. It's extraordinary. And where were we going? With Victoria. I apologize. I'm thinking of the routing here and how brilliant it is. And I can't remember the original question.
Sorry, the original question. You worked there, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So after I that trip to Vancouver, when I figured out that this amazing guy had laid out all these golf courses, I, through Mike Rist, had realized, yes, that Victoria Golf Club was McCann's home base. So I got in touch with the superintendent there. He's still the golf course superintendent. This would have been in the early 2000s, but Paul Robertson. And I started to share some of my knowledge with him relative to McCann's involvement at Victoria and elsewhere. And we sort of struck up a friendship at that point. And then coincidentally, around 2008, 2009, they were simply looking for a golf architect to help them with some problems. And one thing I'm most proud of is I literally think they were just interested in having a golf architect take a look at the course and, again, a system with some problems. I don't think there was any interest within the club's membership to revisit what McCann had done or what the value of that heritage was. So since, working there since 2009, we've done a lot of stuff to bring back some of McCann's original intentions there. But what I'm most proud of is just the heritage is back more than it ever has been. I think that more people around Victoria and Golf Club and a lot of the other McCann heritage clubs that I work at, I think more people are conscious of where their course came from and how important McCann was in terms of pioneering golf architecture in the Pacific Northwest region. That's been very, very gratifying to me because, again, I think he very much came out that way from Ireland and really set a standard for golf in that region that may otherwise have not been set. And it certainly did happen. It began at Victoria and in Colwood up in Victoria, British Columbia.
I understand that a former guest, George Waters, was one of your shapers on the restoration project with you. In reviewing the images of your work at Victoria, one thing that jumps out at me is the bold bunkering. Just wondering if that's a major characteristic of the original formalized routing by AV in the mid 20s.
It's funny. I wouldn't consider McCann to be his bunker styling. I wouldn't point to as his strength as an architect. I think the strength of his work is routing the golf courses, building great greens, contouring the golf course to not only provide for interesting play, but to drainage was a huge thing to McCann. He spoke about it all the time. And you think about the Pacific Northwest. I mean, that's the rainiest place, one of the rainiest places we have here in North America. So he was very cognizant about how important drainage was, particularly surface drainage. Bunkering is interesting on McCann courses. Even when you look at old historic photos, you know, there's not a style you can point to that is, well, that looks like a McCann bunker. Mm-hmm. You know, we have old historic photos that show that he often did grass down, and our presumption is that he put grass down with flat sand floors because, in fact, it rains so much in the Northwest. You know, you don't want bunker faces washing out all the time, so he'd often use grass faces. But then that would be a completely different scenario somewhere else, say in Seattle or Portland, where suddenly we see sand flashed up on bunker faces. It seemed he tried and did different things, and I wonder often if it was all dependent on who was on site building these features for him. Because his bunker styling really, really is very, very versatile and very varied. So on all my projects, including Victoria, we've tried to just follow that lead, you know, where it makes sense to put some sand up for visibility or playability reasons. We've done that. In other areas, we've kept grass down for the simple practical fact that we don't want to promote washouts, considering all the rain and drainage issues they have in the Northwest. So our styling at Victoria, I would say, is not so much inspired by exactly what McCann did there, but it's inspired by how versatile he was and how much variety there is in the type of bunkers that he seems to have designed. Some are very elaborately shaped. Others are just little pits with a grass face, and it goes on from, you know, one extreme to the next. And that's actually what I find very interesting about his bunker styling, is that he was all over the map in terms of shape, sizes, sand up, grass down. I find that to be more interesting than an architect, you know, had a particular bunker layout. McCann certainly was not that way at all.
Gotcha. I mean, one thing is for sure, in reviewing the pictures of Victoria, I'm moved to get there to take a look at the golf course and play it. It looks spectacular.
It's I'd go so far as to say it might be one of the best 6,000-yard golf courses you'll ever play in your life. The routing does an excellent job of you know, creating some big holes on a 6,000-yard golf course, if that makes sense. Tons of great variety. You know, long holes in every par category, short holes in every par category. And the greens, they're not all McCann originals. Some of them are left over from other versions of the golf course, but I would say as a whole, they might be 18 of the most interesting greens on one course that you'll find in Canada. So between the routing on 98 acres and 18 just wonderful greens and surrounds, it'll endure forever. I don't care if people start driving the golf ball 400 yards, you're always going to want to play Victoria. Because you also have the environmental conditions as well. Being on the ocean there, you know, the winds often up and coming in at you from different directions. So wonderful place to play golf.
Yeah, I would like to take a look at some additional work that you've carried out at Firrcrest. I came across a tweet post some phase, at the end of one of the phases of restoration, particularly pertaining to the 17th, I believe the volcano hole, where Bradley Klein was playfully interacting with you on Twitter, basically suggesting that you've just ruined his getting from B to A slideshow. I don't really know what that means. I'm sure you probably do, but I suspect it's something to do with going from something that was good to something maybe not quite so good. So what can you tell us about the volcano hole and maybe what Mr. Klein was speaking to?
Yeah. You know, once I got into McCann and started really doing research on his golf courses, came across a photo. I'm sure Mike Rist had found it, but it was of the 17th hole of Firrcrest. An absolutely spectacular historical photo of a green sitting up on a hill with some really deep, dramatically shaped bunkers on either side. I finally got a chance to get down to Seattle probably 20 years ago. And I said, of course, I've got to go down and see Faircrest. And when I got to Faircrest, I thought 17th hole is pretty close to the clubhouse. I got to go see this famous volcano hole. So I drove down there or walked down there, whatever I did. And I stood in the approach and I thought to myself, where that hole is not here any longer. The green had shrunk. The greenside bunkers were completely gone. Trees had grown up all around the hole, so you could no longer see Mount Rainier in the distance behind the green. So that I was, and Brad Klein had used that photo, the historical photo, and then the evolved photo in presentations he had given over the years to show exactly how Golden Age architecture, you know, had been lost over time. So it was quite disappointing. A few years later, I had gotten engaged after doing some work in Seattle. I was engaged by Faircrest to take a look at the golf course and, of course, we're in the volcano hole. The committee at the time was quite ambitious. I was shocked. And they said, okay, well, if we're going to get back to putting back our you know, McCann design, we should probably restore the volcano hole first. And I thought, oh, boy. Not sure this is the best idea to do the most dramatic thing probably that's been done in Pacific Northwest golf first. I may get fired after this one green site is complete. And there's a funny story leading up to that. They give us the go ahead to break ground and we're restoring the volcano hole. And this older gentleman who had been claimed he had been a member there for 40 or 50 years or whatnot, walked up to one of the guys I work with. I wasn't on site at the time, but he walked up to one of my shapers and he said, this is unbelievable. And Kip, my shaper, said, what, you like it? And he said, no, it's unbelievable that they're letting you do this. And that was the general attitude around the club, is that, you know, they felt like all this McCann stuff that we were putting back was way too severe to be put back. And in many ways, it's incredible to look back and think about people playing these features in 1924, 25. I mean, this green, again, sits up on a plateau of a hill with greenside bunkers that are 10 feet deep on both sides, a bunker low left that you get in feet below the green. Very, very dramatic stuff, but beautiful, but dramatic stuff. But it was a lesson learned for me, because in my master plan, not only did I have restoration of those features around the volcano hole, but moving back into the fairway, that particular fairway is hogback. It's a hog's back fairway, you know, where the high point is right down the center of the fairway. There's a big ridge that runs down the center of the fairway. So it sheds ball. Over the years, big Douglas fir trees were planted in the right and left rough, and they now are big 100-foot tall firs. And I suggested the club that if we were going to restore the volcano green and all the features surrounding it, including those big deep bunkers, we need to get the trees out of the roughs, because what's happening otherwise is that people are hitting what they perceive to be good drives. The hog's back contour in the middle of fairway kicks balls right and kicks balls left. Now, because they haven't removed the trees, there are too many players trying to approach that, you know, difficult green from rough grass underneath Douglas fir trees, because we didn't get the full restoration of the hole complete. And it's funny, I was just at Faircrest a couple of weeks ago. There's a new GM there and a new superintendent. And I explained this story to them. I said, you know, the club allocated funds and gave us the approval to rebuild the green features, but it's all about how the green features relate to approach play, relate to the tee shot that we didn't get correct. So we're hopeful now that we can get back and actually get the fairway back to where it needs to be, so that particular hole works more correctly than it does immediately. And that's a big lesson learned, you know, where it's hard to restore sometimes certain features without the domino effect happening and you needing to actually restore other features so that the entire hole works. So the volcano hole has been a little bit controversial relative to those factors, but we're hopeful we're going to sort it all out here in the near future.
You know, it's interesting as somebody that works in restoring courses and not just, it must be said, not just Davy McCann courses. I believe you've been responsible for renovations of Willie Part Jr. and Donald Ross collaboration and a Chick Evans and Stanley Thompson collaboration, in addition to original design work at the likes of Derek Golf and Winter Club in Alberta. But I suspect that member education with regard to restoration or renovation or improvement is quite important. You know, I've also heard you say that there are probably only 50 great golf courses in the world. Interestingly, I recently had a number of conversations with regard to trying to objectively assess or compare specific courses and the relative merits and specific developmental ceilings. Of course, Alistair McKenzie explained in The Spirit of St. Andrews that golfers have a particular affection for the particular mud heap on which they play. What, in your mind, makes a great golf course? And how do you go about explaining what great golf is to the layman, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think in general that too many contemporary golfers have forgotten that the game is really, the thrill of the game is really based on adventure. You know, you want to, I heard Jeff Ogilvie on a podcast say that, you know, when him and his friends were learning to play golf as kids, they never threw their ball down in a perfect lie and said, let's see if we can get it closer to the hole from here. You'd always slam it in a bunker corner, fried egg lie, wanting to play difficult shots from uneven. That's the thrill of the game. And I think too many golfers, again, have lost the understanding that the game should be adventurous. You know, that's really what a great golf course is. That's why people go to Bend and Dunes, and that's why people travel to Ireland and Scotland and to play these adventurous, you know, rugged golf courses that are going to put you in predicaments that you need to overcome. You know, so in relative to educating members in our business over here in North America, that's the biggest deal. People seem to want to go over and play adventurous golf in Ireland and Scotland and England and abandoned dunes, but then they come back to their home club and they're expecting everything to be perfect in terms of catering to their game, rather than them having to tailor their game to the particular golf course. And I think that's the most frustrating thing in general for architects. So in subtle ways, I try to remind people of that you know, you really want to, it's actually just triggered one of my favorite stories real quick. Somebody told me one time that Bruce Edwards, the old caddy, you know, he caddied for Greg Norman in his heyday and Tom Watson in his heyday. And I use this story at community meetings all the time. You know, they ask, what's the difference between caddying for Norman and Watson when they're both number one in the world? And Bruce Edwards said, well, that's easy. If Greg Norman ripped a drive down the middle and he walked up to it and it was in a divot, he would look down on the divot and he would, his ball in the divot, and he would say, figures, you know, I just hit a perfect drive. Look at this, bad luck again. This is ridiculous. I can't believe that, you know, my ball's in a divot. Conversely, Watson would walk up, find the same situation. He'd study the ball for a second, look at Edwards as he grabbed a club and say, watch this, you know? And that's kind of what I encourage my committee members to do, how to think about golf. You know, think about golf as an adventure. Don't think about golf as our bunkers are no good and our rough isn't uniform and our, you know, blah, blah, blah. Just go find your ball and hit it like they did in the old days. And you know, we need to resurrect that sense of adventure in more golfers' minds. And I think a lot of these developments, all the Kaiser developments, all the Cabot developments in North America have really, really helped with that a lot. I'm finding that a lot of committees and a lot of golfers I'm dealing with that have experience at those golf courses now, or have experience traveling to the British Isles and listening to the Fried Egg and the Firm and Fast podcast. And, you know, people are starting to get it more than ever, which is super encouraging. It really is. Because I think that's our biggest problem. I think people have simply lost that sense of adventure. They really have.
You know, the challenges that you face in North America are no different to the challenges that are faced over here as well, Jeff. The fairness police, the rules of golf in terms of it must be... Four par threes, four par fives, et cetera, over 7,200 yards. Homogenization, I suppose, has become the, I mean, the watchword. And to a certain degree, if we look, and again, I'm not pointing fingers at Mackenzie and Ebert, but hey, hold, why not? Let's have a rattle at this. I mean, there's a feeling amongst some of us, perhaps, and don't get me wrong, they do really good work, but there's a calling card, and people tend to think that nobody ever got fired for buying IBM, and the same was the case when Dr. Hawtrey was the RNA's man, and Donald Steele before him. There's a movement to the median or the mean, and as a result, this adventurous, unfair, variety filled golf becomes unusual, or it's not what we're looking for because we're used to seeing the green grass and the PGA Tour, and you know, reveted bunkers became a thing when the Open started to be broadcast in color, and you know, the shaggy unkempt bunker look wasn't quite, you know. So it's, I guess what I'm getting at here is it's not just unique to the States. It's a fashion is the wrong word, but a feeling probably amongst decision makers that, well, we'll do what's safe as opposed to what isn't safe. And by doing that, I guess in many ways, we use the analogy of Mackenzie when he finished Cypress Point. He was amazed that there wasn't more people giving out because he tried to be as elaborate and as expansive as possible. And I think we need more of that, and more of courses within courses, and more of reverse routing. And actually, you know, what's the next thing as opposed to what are they doing down the road, and let's copy that.
Right. 100%. Yeah, I say to people all the time too that, you know, the only common characteristic that the world's best golf courses share is they're all distinct. You know, so what I like is peculiarity. I think when I go to a golf course and I find it peculiar, that's interesting to me. And I feel like more golfers go somewhere and find a golf course peculiar and they think, well, this is no good. This isn't the golf I know. I like it when it's not the golf I know.
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of perhaps moving away from homogeneity, how important do you think that clarity amongst golf club membership and indeed the boards and the councils out there in order to optimize the longitudinal and or iterative process of improving a golf course? How important do you think clarity is in relation to that process?
I think it's very important, but at the same time, I do believe that every club is made up of thirds, which is another thing I share. I really feel like there's 33% of golfers at every club that understand what needs to be done, that understand that golf courses evolve and architects and superintendents and other consultants need to be consistently involved to advise on, you know, just standard upkeep and maintenance of a golf course. And again, 33% of club members will always understand that. There's another 33% at the other end of the spectrum that don't want anyone involved. They don't want a consultant there, whether it be an architect or a turf agronomic consultant. Our course is fine. Leave it alone. We don't need any work done. And that's never a good thing. You know, you've constantly got to be putting, it's like owning a house. I mean, you're constantly going to have to be putting capital investment into your property in order to and simply keep it up. The key people at any club in terms of clarity and education are the middle 33%, you know, a group that are either ambivalent or, you know, they just don't really pay attention or care as to what's happening. And I think if you can get to those people, and make it clear to them exactly, you know, what's being proposed and what needs to be done on a consistent basis to make this particular golf course the best that it can be. You tend to have 66% of a membership on your side. And I think in terms of club politics, that's an amazing ratio. The 33% are never going to agree with you, are never going to get it. And they're the ones who make it most frustrating for us. So again, I think we could concentrate on that middle 33 and then the support of that optimistic and positive 33%. You know, that's what I always try to focus on, because that negative 33% can really, really drag you down and really get things off the rails in terms of what needs to be done, just simply needs to be done in terms of remedial, you know, from a remedial perspective, if anything, not even a redesign perspective. Work needs to be done consistently.
Some of my guests, our subjects, haven't written very much, and you, on the other hand, are pretty prolific. It's only when I went looking in the library of my various copies of Paul Daly's Golf Architecture series, numerous Golf Architecture magazine and Score magazine articles, and indeed even a Society of Australian Golf Course Architects article, to name but a few. You obviously enjoy writing.
I do. And I think that stems back to all the reading I did when I was a kid, going, you know, we've come full circle here with my dad's library. I really enjoyed reading as a kid, and it made me, you know, it made me an admirer of a lot of the people that I was reading. And I thought to myself, you know, I admire these people. I wouldn't mind being like them. John Lowe, Avi McCann, Alistair McKenzie. You know, a lot of the great architects were great writers, and I think it did a lot of good for the game. And I think I was naively romantic as a youngster, you know, where I thought, I need to put all of this stuff I'm learning out there so that I can help people, just like all these other old books helped me. And I think that's really what triggered my interest in writing. But I also knew too that it was going to help me probably promote myself in terms of being someone who is capable of giving some architectural assistance.
We might take a look at your recent article you published very soon after this year's US Open, looking at George Thomas's Los Angeles Country Club. The article was entitled, It's Not About Hard or Easy, It's About Intrigue. Before we jump into some discussion points, you might introduce the listeners to what you wrote and why you were compelled to write it.
Los Angeles Country Club's North Course is one of the most fascinating places I've ever visited in my life. It's an incredible golf course design. It checks every box. It's an amazing routing over a remarkably beautiful property. George Thomas's routing not only creates great golf holes, but it shows off this wonderful property in tremendous fashion. The greens are great. Everything about it's great. I love the Los Angeles Country Club. And after that first day, when there were a couple of 62s there, I was a little bit frustrated relative to a lot of the commentary just being, oh, it's too easy. You know, I thought, boy, you're really, again, I've talked about this relative to McCann courses, where people for some reason just can't get into the nuance. You know, they have a hard time. It's just about fairway widths and, you know, traps that penalize poor shots. And I just felt like the entire nuance of the Los Angeles Country Club was being missed in this argument about whether or not the golf course was too easy to be a US Open host. And I just thought that was so silly. And it just struck a nerve too, relative to what we consistently deal with when we're renovating existing club courses in particular. You know, you typically do a lot of these projects in phases, right? So you'll make a change to, you know, four holes in phase one and five holes in phase two, and what, you know, and you'll finish a project off like that in three or four phases over 3 or 4 years. And people nitpick about the hard and easy argument. Firkrest is a wonderful example of this. That when we started our work putting McCann stuff back, I had a group of members write a letter signed by, you know, 20 or 30 members petitioning that we made the second hole too easy because we removed the greenside bunkers. We made the third hole or too hard because we deepened the greenside bunkers. We made the 16th hole too easy because we removed some trees that widened the chute off the tee. And then the volcano hole we made too difficult by putting the deep bunkers back. So I paused for a second. I said to them, so we made 2 too easy, 3 too hard, 16 too easy, and 17 too hard. Well, I think we might be on the right track. We've got some balance happening here, you know? And people just looked at me like, what is he talking about? But I'm like, why are we nitpicking? We've got so much interest and so much intrigue in all these holes relative to slope, contour, bunkering. And we don't play golf like robots. We're not hitting it in the middle of the fairway and onto the green. We're all going to be in different places, different days, depending how we feel, depending what the wind's doing, et cetera, et cetera. I think people just overanalyze golf courses relative to hard and easy, relative, you know, instead of looking at intrigue. Is the golf course intriguing? Do I want to cut? Is it beautiful? Does it present me with interesting shots? You can have an interesting shot, hit a great shot, and make birdie. That's fine. You know, that's the confusing part to me in the hard versus easy argument. You know, I often say to people that when I'm playing well, I mean, the so-called hard holes can be really easy. If I'm playing poorly, the so-called easy holes can be quite hard when you're not playing well. So I'm just bothered overall by the hard versus easy argument. I thought highlighting some of the intrigue that's presented at Los Angeles Country Club was a perfect example just to highlight how silly the hard versus easy conversation is sometimes.
But, you know,
not sometimes, all the time.
All the time, yeah. No, it speaks to that, you know, that stereotypical open doctor, RTJ, the job he did in the 60s onwards in relation to US Open venues, difficult courses were the best courses. You know, the Golf Digest list entitled the toughest 200 courses in America. It became a synonymous with good golf, and we've been conditioned as a result in the favor of protection of the notion of par for some strange reason. Grow the rough, narrow the fairways, plant trees, where golf becomes homogenous again, a test of execution as opposed to adventure with nuance and light and shade.
Well, another one of my favorite quotes, I think it's to paraphrase Ben Crenshaw. I think he said, you know, the easiest thing to do is make a course hard. And it's true. It's very, very easy to make a golf course difficult. As you said, narrow the fairways, deepen the bunkers, make the greens fast. I mean, that's pretty basic stuff. It's not basic. You got to put some thought into making a golf course intriguing, particularly intriguing for players of all abilities. And that's where that's where really great golf architecture shines. And again, getting back to the Los Angeles Country Club, I just felt here's a great, great golf course that, you know, the television commentators in particular, they should have been highlighting its nuances and its intrigue. But instead, no, this fairway is too wide, this hole's too easy. And anyway, that's what triggered right in that article. I sent a text to the editor, Jason Logan of Score Golf Magazine. I said, I got an idea for a column if you're interested. He bit.
It's well worth a read, actually, as well. I'll put a link to the article in the show notes. I mean, just interesting, apropos LACC, and I've not been there yet. Hopefully someday, but certainly in terms of the boxes, and look, I obviously it being West Coast in California, you know, my viewing was up until 3:30 or 3:45 in the morning. So, but I really thought it sort of got across a distinct sense of place with the Barrancas, very, very distinct visuals. And obviously, the variety and the routing in terms of course setup, the course within a course idea, and those greens, the pure distinction sod, which I first came across in Victoria Golf Club in Melbourne back in 2020. Some of the best sports turf I've ever put it on. So I wasn't surprised to hear the players extol the virtues of the pure distinction bent greens. They looked phenomenal, and certainly I suspect they played phenomenally as well. Have you used Pure Distinction yourself?
Yeah, it's actually becoming quite a popular turf throughout North America here. At least in the northern parts of the continent here.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, apropos one final chat. Obviously, you saw Jay Monahan's recent communication with regard to the ball and the model local rule. How do you think, in an ideal world, with regard to ball and technology, and the ever, what appears to be the ever greater march towards 8,000-yard golf courses for the professionals, and indeed any other golf course that perhaps considers itself as a championship golf course, not just in the United States or Canada, but around the world, and the knock-on effect of that? I mean, how do you think, or in an ideal world, how would you think that the powers that be, the RNA and the USGA, should address the particular challenges that the likes of Acushnet are creating? And look, let's not forget this equipment debate has been going on since 1902, and the introduction of the Haskell ball. So it's something that circle has not been squared for forever, really. But something has to happen, I suspect. I'm just wondering what you think that something might be.
You know, it's funny, Shane. I used to put a lot more thought in this subject than I do now. You know, for 30 years, I was a big advocate, you know, of slowing the golf ball down and shortening its capabilities. I feel like nowadays, I think the less attention a majority of golfers pay to high level pro golf, the better. I don't think there's a lot of good influence coming out of high level professional golf at all these days. And I know that sounds arrogant, but when we think about, you know, regular golf, you know, for regular people, I don't think the pro game relates to it at all. As we've seen recently, the pro game, I mean, it's all about profit. It's so profit driven, and it's all about money, and it's all about pro golfers making money. And I think the best decisions that have ever been made in golf over the years had nothing to do with money. It has everything to do with the integrity of the game. And I don't think anything that Jay Monahan said shows any integrity relative to what is best for the health of the game in the long term. I mean, I always go back to what William Flynn, the legendary architect, said, I think back in the 30s. You know, it's simple. Longer ball means longer, bigger courses, which cost more to build, more to maintain, cost more to play. There's nothing good in that equation. And anyone who doesn't realize that there's nothing good in that equation, it's like that low end 33% of the people I talked about at clubs. I mean, they're never going to get it. They're making the decisions for the wrong reasons. There could be nothing better than for us to have more 6,300 yard golf courses that people can play in 3.5 hours, where the ball's not flying all over the place. Longer it goes, more sideways it goes too, right? That's a lot of, I notice a lot of people don't understand that. I mean, even for high level amateur players, I mean, if they're able to hit 300 yards, it's going off line much further than it would otherwise. So that leads to, you know, the necessity of having bigger golf courses that, again, cost more to build, cost more to maintain. Inevitably, they cost more to play. The long ball equation is no good at all. And it's very, very simple. I think it's as simple as that in my mind, for whatever that's worth. I'm certainly not going to be solicited for advice from the RNA, but that's my opinion.
It's worth a lot. And look, I mean, just tying it back into A.V. McCann, I mean, you know, focus on the member ultimately pays the bills, whatever length that particular golf course and the equipment has to be facilitated. You know, one last question about A.V. The great Lorne Rubenstein described you as a McCann connoisseur. I'm just wondering if that particular description or moniker has conferred some degree of pressure and or expectation on your good self.
Maybe to some degree, but I do take it as a compliment in terms of just, you know, spreading the word about what golf is. You know, another famous William Flynn quote that I've always loved is, you know, a golf architect should never forget his role in the game as an educator. You know, and I feel McCann really felt the same way too. You know, he spent a lot of time, those guys both did, they spent a lot of time studying the game, both in terms of playing and architecture and other aspects. And not as many people, you know, there's not that many people out there that study the game in depth. And I've taken pride in just sort of following someone like McCann's example and trying to learn as much as I can, and then explain to people, you know, where the game needs to be and what should happen in small little instances at clubs with their courses or other issues. And yeah, I take that as a huge compliment. And I'm basically just trying to follow the lead of leaders like that. You know, they were great leaders in the game. And I feel like I'm very privileged to at least attempt to serve a similar purpose in golf.
You're very self-deprecating, Jeff. You're doing a great job, so keep it up. You know, regular listeners will know that all my new guests get asked the same final two questions. The first one pertains to five bucket list courses of your choosing. You can choose to interpret the question however you wish. It can be courses you've played, courses you've not played, place you'd like to see, place you'd like to see again, etc., etc. And even if it's a please don't do a Joe McDonald on it and go back in a time machine. But if you want to do that, you can do that too.
Five bucket list courses. Well, the first thing that pops to mind is I have not been to Australia.
Okay, you need to rectify
that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a huge void. So as far as bucket list courses go, it's fairly easy there, right? You got both the Royal Melbourne, you got Kingston Heath. Throw in any two more of probably 20 that are worth seeing down there. I need to rectify that sooner than later.
Jeff, we might call that a bucket list location. So that's only one, okay? So yeah, you're talking Melbourne and Tasmania, and obviously you got to wait until 7 Mile Beach opens up as well. So we'll call that one, right? Just to give you a little bit of leeway, okay, because you've just eaten all your courses there. So we're going to do that, okay?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I got two more similar ones that I think I've done a really good job of seeing the big name courses in Scotland. Mm-hmm. But I would really like to get around and see more of the, you know, local courses that aren't open road of places and aren't, you know, Castle Stewart and the bigger Trump Turnberry, and get around and just see a little bit more of how the local golf works a little bit better in Scotland would be a real bucket list.
Where
to go on a trip and not visit any of the, you know, any of the names that people in North America recognize, but get into town golf, you know.
Okay, gotcha. One's the start. Somewhere like Montrose comes to mind. Somewhere that starts in the center of town and comes back to the center of town.
You know, one that I always point out to people that a lot of people traveling over there don't even seem to have on their itinerary ever is Ely.
Yeah.
I love that golf course. Just south of St. Andrews where James Braid grew up. Yeah, it's you know, little places like that and little towns that you're not going to find a lot of golfing tourists in, and just see how it works locally. I'm fascinated by that.
Okay. So there's two.
So that's only two.
Yeah. That's two. we have a lot of leeway.
You know, I could say the same thing too. I could say the same thing too about Long Island. Uh-huh. You know, of course I love the National and Shinnecock, and Garden City is one of my favorite places for golf anywhere. But there's a treasure trove of stuff on Long Island I still haven't delved into either. I think you could do a similar trip, although most of them are private clubs, unlike in Scotland, where you could probably just simply pay a green fee and get on. But I think Long Island is incredibly deep in terms of quality architecture. And sometimes, you know, that's what I am fascinated by. I mean, it's easy to point to the big guys and say, hey, this is a great golf course. But I love stumbling across something on a fairly unknown golf course that I find fascinating, you know, whether it be, you know, the layout of a particular hole or series of holes or a green or a bunker. I love, that's inspiring to me, is to find something somewhere that, you know, that it, that I'm never going to see in a book or in a magazine.
What and when was the last time that happened to you in a golf course, out of interest?
Oh boy, that is a great question. And now I talk about feeling pressure. I should have a really great answer to that. I will say that it does happen frequently. Uh-huh. And even sometimes in my own work, you know, I have something in my mind in terms of what we're going to build. And then as we're building it, it morphs into something different. That's always exciting too. That just happened a couple of times working on a project right now at Ottawa, you know, Canada's nation, our nation's capital, at Rivermead Golf Club. And then, you know, we were playing around with some stuff and having some difficulty shaping some things. And whenever it turns into something that you hadn't anticipated, but was better than you originally thought, those are always great experiences too. But I wish I could think of something I tripped on. Leave it with me.
No problem.
Might come to me.
No problem. So we've three. So you've two more either bucket list locations or specific golf courses. I guess we're going to go with locations, seeing as you've gone with three locations so far.
I may have run out of locations. I will say that Garden City is something that that never leaves my mind. I probably haven't visited Garden City Golf Club in over 15 years. I need to get back, but Garden City Golf Club has stuck in my mind as nearly something close to my ideal of where I would want to play golf every day of my life.
Wow.
Love to get back there.
Am I right in saying Garden City is a particularly relatively flat site? Would that be fair?
Relatively flat. Yes, I would say that. Not flat, but relatively flat would be fair to say.
Okay.
It would be a golf course that, you know, it reminds me of what I think it's Herbert Warren Wind's, or not Herbert Warren Wind, Jim Murray, the famous LA Times columnist. I think he went to Royal Lytham and St. Anne's years ago for the Open, and he looked out onto the golf course and he said, geez, it looks like a vacant lot in Cleveland, you know, and that's what Garden City looks like in a lot of ways. And I mean that as a compliment. It's not a golf course that most golfers would look out on and go, oh, wow, that's beautiful. It's more, it gets back to that intriguing point we were talking about, you know, where it's kind of, you look out there and you go, this is, well, peculiar. We used that word earlier too. You know, this is peculiar. And again, that's where I gravitate towards. Even that's part of my bucket list. I gravitate towards peculiar.
But you know, let's remember, views are nice, but you can't play views.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen, exactly. I think
maybe my next bucket list, my fifth, because I have not played in Ireland either.
You haven't?
A huge.
May you be struck down, Mr. Mingay. May you be struck down.
I know.
We need to rectify that particular situation.
I'll stop there on my way to Australia.
It's in the wrong direction, but anyway.
I know.
You're always welcome. You're always welcome.
On my way
welcome.
Back.
Exactly. And you know, there's a direct flight from Toronto, so you can't say it's not easy to get to, you know?
It's very easy from Toronto.
Yeah. Right. Finally, the last question pertains to two book recommendations. What two book recommendations would you proffer to listeners looking to augment their golfing libraries?
Well, for those interested in golf course architecture, I always recommend Tom Doak's The Anatomy of a Golf Course. I think it is. I've read every book there is on golf course architecture, and I think Tom's book is the best intro that anyone can have to golf course architecture. It's very simple to read, and it actually leads you in the direction of other books and great courses around the world. I'm a huge Tom Doak fan. Other than my dad, maybe Rod Whitman would be third. Tom Doak really inspired me in my career in the late 80s. I mean, I remember going up to High Point, his first golf course, because I didn't live far away. I grew up in Windsor, Ontario, across the river from Detroit. So High Point was only, you know, 4-hour drive from home. And my dad, my brother, and a friend of ours drove up and played High Point. It was it was an epiphany. I mean, it was like, wow, I've never seen a golf. It was minimalism when no one knew what the heck that meant, you know? And when you look back on it now, I mean, yeah, along with his early courses and the anatomy of a golf course, I mean, Tom changed everything. And I would highly recommend the anatomy of a golf course to anyone who hasn't read it.
You must be getting really excited that he's rebuilding much of it.
You know, it's going to be something to see because it's not exactly the original course, but there's going to be some of the original holes, as I understand it.
It's
very interesting for that place to have come around to where it is right now, and I'm sure Tom's thrilled, and he should be. That's such a deserving project for him at this point in his career too. It's great. I guess the second one would probably be The Links by Robert Hunter. Always pops into mind. I think that's Tom's is a very practical read on golf architecture that again will lead you to some great places. I think Robert Hunter's The Links from 1926 is a very entertaining read.
Yeah,
he does a great job in parts of that book where he talks about watching famous players play and how. And he describes architecture in probably the most entertaining way of any of the architecture books that I've read.
There's a fantastic story that he tells about a visit to Hoylake, Royal Liverpool, obviously.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Playing with John Ball Jr., who kept missing greens and kept trying to say, well, how about a bet? No, I'm taking the bet on. And he'd chip it in from off the green, and he just kept doing it. Like, he was sort of early 50s at that stage, but still hadn't lost it.
Yeah, that I was just thinking that exactly. And that's right at the beginning of the book, actually. Yeah. So it grabs your attention.
Yeah.
Right away. Fantastic.
Jeff, before we let you go, you might let listeners know how they can keep track of you, your design work, and indeed your writing.
Well, I'm not as good as I used to be at it, but and it's not even called Twitter anymore.
I'm still calling it Twitter anyway.
I do a little bit of social media. Yeah. Do a little bit of social media. You can find me, my name, Jeff Mingay, on Instagram. Twitter, Facebook, and then jeffmingay.com. Very simple. I'm in the process of updating my website right now with so much going on. We've got a bunch of great links to other media, you know, podcasts and articles and things like that. So jeffmingay.com, you can find everything you'd want to see and read about me and my affiliations with golf architecture.
Perfect, Jeff. Listen, many thanks for your time this afternoon. It really, really is appreciated. Continued success with spreading the good word about golf architecture and Avi McCann in particular, and obviously refining and restoring the character of some of his long-forgotten portfolio of Pacific Northwest gems. Take it easy, mate. Thanks a million.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Many thanks for tuning in. As usual, you can find us online at firmandfast.golf or on Twitter at firmandfastgolf. Please continue to like, subscribe, and comment. It really is appreciated. Until the next time, happy golfing.